the originalists believe that everything you need to know can be found in either the text of the Constitution or in the founding documents such as the Federalist Papers, and they're not interested in anything that has happened ever since. And so that the original intent is all that matters. And the story that I always tell my class is the following. In 1777, after the Battle of Saratoga, the French came to our aid in the American Revolution, and as part of the package, we signed a treaty that should France ever be involved in a war, we would protect the West Indies possessions. In 1793, France is involved in a war with Great Britain, and they call upon the United States to protect their West Indies possessions. The only problem is we didn't have a navy. So George Washington asks his cabinet what to do. Everybody's agreed we should declare neutrality because there's no way we can fulfill the treaty. And Hamilton suggests to Washington, he just issue a proclamation of neutrality. Jefferson, who's the Secretary of State, says, no, 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 you have to go to Congress. Only Congress can declare war, therefore only Congress can declare neutrality. Washington listens to Hamilton, issues the Declaration of Neutrality. Jefferson says to Madison, take up your pen, dear sir, and strike this heresy. So Madison writes a series of essays saying that Washington is wrong. Hamilton responds, they're both writing under Latin pseudonyms. And the reason I bring this story up is that Washington presided over the Constitutional Convention. Madison is considered the father of the Constitution. Hamilton was at the Constitutional Convention, and these people were there, and 6 years later, they don't know what it means. The text does not tell them. There is absolutely nothing in the Federalist, nothing in the ratifying debates, so that you can't always get what you want out of that. Justice Brennan, I think, had the right idea when he said, you take a look at what they said and you try to infer from it what that would mean for our time. And so I suppose you would call me an advocate of a living constitution.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the originalists, though, like Justice Scalia, for example, would argue if it's so malleable, it loses its value.
Well, Scalia is now saying, and I guess he's been saying it for a while, that he's not an originalist. He's a textualist, which is a difference. For him...
Nuanced.
Well, it's more than that. He doesn't look at anything other than the text of the Constitution. He doesn't look at the Federalist Papers. He doesn't look at the ratifying debates. He looks just at what's within the four corners of the Constitution. And he's come up with some very interesting decisions based on that. One of which is he's a great believer in the Confrontation Clause. And so it was his opinion that said that when you have laboratory testing by the FBI, they can't just send you a written report to be handed in at the trial. You have to have the technician there to testify as to what it means, that the defendant is entitled to confront his accuser. And this includes people who are providing evidence.
You have written a lot about the importance of dissent on the court, and I want to read a quote from you about that. And the quote is, the dissenters initiate the dialogue over what a particular provision should mean, and many dissents are wrong, but the dialogue is critical.
Yes, I probably did say that because I agree with that, so I must have said it. Most dissents are forgotten very quickly. Some dissents are those of pique. You know, you people don't know what you're talking about. But then some dissents are what we call the prophetic dissents or the canonical dissents. And these are the ones that ultimately win out. You know, perhaps there's a new book out called The Great Dissent, which talks about Holmes' dissent in the speech cases and how that changed the whole jurisprudence of free speech. Brandeis, in a famous case called Olmstead versus the United States, laid down the basis in his dissent for what became the right of privacy 20 years later. It's an appeal, as Chief Justice Hughes said, to the intelligence of a future day. Sometimes the dissents are, as I said, peakish. We don't remember them, but there's an awful lot of majority decisions we don't remember either. What happens on something, I'll give you perhaps a good, easy example, is in the 1940s, the Supreme Court handed down a decision saying that states did not have to provide counsel in state criminal cases to people accused of crimes, that the Sixth Amendment did not apply to the states. And Justice Black writes a very strong dissent saying that a defendant cannot get a fair trial without a lawyer. The court in that case says there are some exceptions. Now, if the defendant is not mentally competent, if it's a very complicated legal matter beyond the ken of a layman, then there should be a lawyer. For the next 20 years, every time an appeal comes up to the Supreme Court, they manage to find an exception that requires the state to provide a lawyer. Until finally, in the very famous case of Gideon versus Wainwright, the court reverses itself, and fittingly, it's Justice Black, who is still on the court, who writes the majority opinion in Gideon. So there's a dissent that kept the dialogue going for some 20 years until it finally wins out.
You've also said that, quote, a completely liberal court would be as dangerous as a completely conservative one.
Yes. Constitution and the cases that come before the court are not easy. If they were easy, they wouldn't get to the Supreme Court. They'd be settled down below. Now, we tend to think of the Warren Court as a very liberal court, very activist court. But if you go back and look at the cases, with the exception of the racial segregation cases, most of their opinions are not unanimous. You do have a conservative bloc led by Felix Frankfurter and John Marshall Harlan II, who disagree in the criminal rights cases. With the exception of Gideon, there's usually a dissenting bloc. And what the dissent does is hem in the majority from going too far.
Would you think it's inaccurate to characterize the Roberts Court under that criteria as a conservative court?
No, it is. The majority is conservative. But it would go a lot further if it didn't have the moderate bloc of the three women and Justice Breyer. Stephen Alito is, I think, one of the most conservative justices that's been appointed in a long time. He's far more conservative than Sandra Day O'Connor, whom he replaced. And you can see in some opinions where he is really willing to push further than the majority is willing to go. But as Justice Brennan used to say, the magic number is five. And when you're writing the majority opinion, you have to write it so that at least five members of the court, four others besides yourself, will agree with what you say. And if you go too far in one direction, you're liable to lose somebody. Now, they'll concur in the result, but not in the reasoning. So almost every judge I've interviewed or read has said the same thing. When you're writing the majority opinion, you have to be very careful. You write a very narrow opinion, keeps it full. We think of Brandeis as the great dissenter, but the majority of the opinions he wrote on the court were for the majority. And if you look at them, they're very different. They're short to the point. He's got a paragraph where he states the facts, a paragraph where he gives the legal reasoning, and a paragraph where he gives the conclusion.
Must be more fun to write the dissenting opinion.
Oh, it is. Justice Scalia has said that, and William O. Douglas said writing a dissent is the only thing that enables a person to keep their sanity here.
Well, the court is such a fascinating thing to study and to research, yeah. And I've been speaking with Melvin Urosky, who is a constitutional law scholar and someone who's done a lot of that research and shared it with us, thankfully. Dr. Urosky, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.